So yes, the time of rich summer air has come. I love that piece. Thank you. And with it, the season of light and life and love, fresh peaches, barbecues, fireworks, sunshine. In many pagan traditions, it is the time when the god gives way to the goddess, when goodness reigns across the land and all mortality celebrates the vibrance of creation and evolution. So in a few days, we mark the time of the summer solstice, also known in some pagan traditions as Litha. Litha marks the peak of solar energy, which is thought of traditionally as masculine, the peak of solar energy in the wheel of the year. At the moment of the solstice, the sun has reached this point above the Earth's surface, farthest north of the equator, and it's neither waxing nor waning, but at a standstill, just for a moment, as if the sun itself were enjoying the moment of peak power. Daylight shines longer on this day than any other, and each day has been longer since the last, right? Since winter solstice. And the coming months, even though it'll get warmer and warmer, the coming months will actually bring the decline of solar energy as the days get shorter and the nights get longer. The goddess will once again reign and step before the god, just as the moon periodically eclipses the sun. And the darkness of midwinter will bring death and rebirth. The summer solstice has been celebrated for thousands of years. The tradition of honoring the peak of masculine energy, the peak of the sun god's power and persuasion, has always included a bonfire. A huge fire with flames reaching 20 feet in the air could not be more appropriate as the symbol of power and masculinity and action and life and change. Fire is the most easily seen and immediately felt element of transformation. It can burn, consume, cook, shed light, or purify. And because of its heat, fire is most intimately associated with the sun. Because of the sun's obvious role at Litha, this has been a time of fire rituals and fire festivals, and bonfires still figure prominently at modern celebrations. Ritual celebrations included things like jumping through the flames of the solstice bonfire to encourage the newly sprouted crops to grow taller. Couples hoping for babies ran through the flames holding hands. Amulets or charms that were thought to have served their purpose or lost their effectiveness were tossed into bonfires, since disposing of them in any other way guaranteed 12 months of bad luck. In some places, once the fire had burned and only glowing coals remained, people might walk barefoot in the glowing embers in rites of purification or protection. Here in Madison, we write wishes onto pieces of paper and toss them into fire as drummers drum and dancers dance. Did any of you go to the celebration at Olbrich Park last night? A couple of you, yeah. Flowers are another important symbol of midsummer, representing the energy that the living things here on Earth take from the sun and the abundance we're blessed with in this season. Active, growing energy is really strong in living things right now. And that can be seen in our lush gardens, right? And our woods. The trees are completely leafed out now, and those leaves are very busy processing the sunlight energy to make food, which will then be moved into the tree's roots as the sun's energy declines as the season goes on, where it will be stored for the winter, like putting up peaches in jars. And we, too, we can revel. Can you tell I didn't get much sleep last night? We can revel in the abundant energy of life and love in this season. Gardening, eating fresh food, spending time in nature, noticing, just noticing the long, bright days, gathering with our loved ones. These are all ways we bring the abundant energy of summer into our lives. We can fill ourselves and each other with all of these different kinds of energy, and we can start to store it in our own roots as winter's shorter days and colder temperatures start to approach. The god and goddess of pagan tradition are personifications of our own traits, much like the four directions, symbols of those attributes that make us human. So when we celebrate the peak of the god's power, as seen in the longest day of the year, we're really celebrating our own strength, our ability to rise up, to feel and enjoy our bodies, to see our blessings and hold gratitude for them, to shine our lights out into a world that so badly needs warmth and brightness. And when we acknowledge that the power of the god is about to wane, we're really acknowledging that the power in this world can shift, can be claimed by those who believe they have none. In this time and in this world, as we face daily onslaughts of hate and fear, it is so important to remember that there is also abundance in nature and in our nature, that we hold an abundance of warmth and brightness and power. This is why I love how Liz James deconstructed the stone soup story. I, like many others, have always heard this story with that scarcity mindset, right? Assuming that the people in the village felt like they had to hold on to the little they had because it wasn't enough for even them. This goes against what I know, though. The people in my life now who have little means are also the most generous people that I know. And yet, somehow I've learned to believe that there's never enough, that some have to go without, that sharing goes against my best interests. I've learned to believe that if someone doesn't have enough, it's because they're not a productive member of society, and to value the accumulation of stuff for myself over the common good. And yes, I have learned that I am powerless to change this. I am constantly working on unlearning all of that, on pushing back against the narrative of the meritocracy and embracing the first and seventh principles of our faith tradition, the inherent worth and dignity of all, and the interconnected web of which we're all a part, in a practical and immediate way. Through the lens that Liz offers, this story helps me to do that. It's really about a couple of things. And the first is that we need to learn we are not powerless. That the things we have that seem insignificant can be offered into a co-creative process to build amazing new realities. That maybe each of us individually can't feed someone else, but together we sure can. That we all have to learn to see the twin cultures of white supremacy and extractive consumerism that undergird our society for what it really is, a structure built and maintained to support the belief that some lives matter more than others, and to keep the money and the power in the hands of a few at the expense of the rest. And that we have to unlearn the false narrative that each person is solely responsible for their own survival and success, and see the reality that we are deeply dependent on each other, and that we need one another for all of us to thrive. And that we don't know what might emerge when we gather with purpose and make space for resourcefulness and creativity. I'm using the term emerge here the way Adrienne Marie Brown, who wrote the book Emergent Strategy, does, to describe these small things that happen between us as we interact with each other and how they combine to become complex patterns and systems, kind of like in a forest. Different species of trees grow at different rates until in a mature forest, there are trees of all different sizes, right? And they interact with each other in lots of ways. Roots intertwining, canopies spread out in both competition and cooperation. But a forest isn't just the trees. There are animals that eat leaves and seeds that impact which trees might survive and which ones might thrive. And there are insects, some of which also eat or damage leaves, some of which can actually do so much damage under the bark of a tree, it can eventually kill it. And other insects pollinate the tree's flowers in the spring and help to create the seeds that will become the next generation. And then mushrooms, mushrooms that reach their mycelia or their roots into live wood that could kill a tree, into dead wood that makes decomposition happen, that releases nutrients into the forest floor to feed the other plants. Or I'm learning between tree roots to create this web of connection and communication. Each of these parts are relatively simple in and of themselves, and in their interaction, a complex system emerges. That brings me to the second point about Liz's deconstruction, the visitor to the village. They didn't leave in defeat after being turned away from house after house. Instead, they used what they had learned about being in need and what they knew about the human condition to draw the best out of the villagers. They helped their siblings realize that they had more to offer than they had known and showed them what can happen for the common good when they realize what a big contribution they had thought of as unworthy can be. Feeling powerless can get in the way of the emergence of new ways of being and being together. And sometimes we need that catalyst, those people that help us remember what we have to offer. This is one of the ways we need each other to remind us that it's the systems of white supremacy and extractive consumerism working to keep us feeling powerless, not our natures. Our Unitarian Universalist theology tells us that we are all worthy of love, no matter what, and that we can rest in that love, knowing that it is enough and that we are enough. So when we experience the nudge of a catalyst urging us into a state where we can find a little bit of power and let emergence happen, it can remind us that we're part of that web, right? That everyone else in it has worth and is deserving of dignity, that we all have the means to make that a real lived experience for all. Everything happening around us calls us to do so, especially in this season of light and life and love and abundance.